We are now audio recording. It will go up along with the deck sometime later this evening in all likelihood. So welcome all to our, I guess it's our third, or is it fourth, Q&A of the year. We have a good sized deck tonight, but we should have time for additional questions and so forth. If you have anything that has come up last minute and you didn't get it sent in to the suggestion box email address. And so I will now do the mute all. And again, you do have the ability to unmute yourself if you want to, or throw it into the chat if you have any comments or questions. And with that, I will toss it over to Alan to lead us through the deck for tonight. Alan.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And as Chris said, we have quite a lot of material, and a lot of it is developed prior to the meeting. So I'd really like to thank everybody who sent in some input questions or answers to questions, and also a whole bunch of suggested things. Anyway, let's crack on and we'll bail right into it. He hopes. There we go. So the first one is Bob Walker last week asked if I was talking about VirtualBox, and he asked, was it possible to run Android inside VirtualBox on a Windows machine? And the answer is yes. And here's a How to Geek web page from a while ago. And basically, you do it exactly the way I was describing. You use an ISO file, so you have to, and this website tells you where to find an Android.iso file. And once you have that ISO file, you install that as your virtual machine, and then you're basically running Android, as it shows here, on top of Windows. So if you're interested in seeing how Android works, that's certainly one way to do it without an Android device per se. Okay, moving on. Chris has a follow-up again from a question last week about registry cleaners.
Yeah, so I came out pretty adamantly against registry cleaners, and there was one person on the call who had a problem fixed by somebody going into the registry and fixing things. Registry cleaners, as opposed to just going into the registry and making changes in the registry, is two entirely different things. This site here, decentsecurity.com, they talk about the fact that registry cleaners don't fix problems, they invent problems. And so they've done lots of work with clients and so forth around the world, tens of thousands of machines. They regularly do go into the registry and they change configurations. They fix things by going into very specific areas of the registry where there are issues. They have never used a registry cleaner per se to fix a problem. The difference is a registry cleaner just goes through the entire registry looking for problem areas, coming up with a big scary list of things that need to be fixed and offer to fix them for you. And it's willy-nilly, not really willy-nilly, but it's a lot more than a targeted going into the registry looking for a solution to a specific problem. They say that they have never done anything in the registry that would have been fixed using a registry cleaner. And they have actually had employees that screwed up their computers by running registry cleaners. So they say that inevitably, if you run a registry cleaner, it will find lots and lots of issues. And they actually pointed out that a brand new installation of Windows installation will actually come up with a registry cleaner saying that there are all kinds of problems that need to be fixed. And they liken it to buying a brand new car and having a having headlight fluid need to be replaced on the car. It's the same scam as that. And so they say that professionals absolutely never use a registry cleaner to fix a problem. They will actually go in with the registry editor to fix problems that are very specific, that they know where to go and what to fix. But they say registry cleaners don't fix problems, they invent problems. And I support that. Microsoft has a policy on it. So the URL is there, and I pasted it into the chat window as well. They do not support the use of registry cleaners. They say they're not responsible for any issues caused by using a registry cleaner. They strongly recommend that you only go into the registry if you know what you're doing or have been instructed to make a specific change from a source that you actually trust. And they say issues caused by these utilities may not be repairable, and they are 100% right. You could go in and, using a registry cleaner, potentially end up with an unbootable Windows. So the last week problem was a Chrome problem, and that was solved by an external service remoting to the person's computer and doing some corrections. So they had tried to reinstall, they had tried emptying the cache and so forth, and then the repair place came in remotely, did some changes in the registry, and the problem was fixed. I strongly suspect that they just didn't run just a registry cleaner. They actually went in and did a targeted look for specific areas of the registry dealing only with Chrome, and either removed them all and then installed Chrome, or fixed a specific Chrome setting. I suspect that probably what they did was they just removed all the registry entries they could find that dealt with Google Chrome and then reinstalled Chrome, and everything was okay. So if you're actually going to go in and do edits to the registry, it's recommended that you do have a backup image of your entire disk, or at least your partition where Windows boots from, before you actually start. You can use the registry editor, regedit.exe, and you should use it as an administrator so that it can make changes outside of the user portion of the registry. And then you can search in the registry looking for specific text strings, either in the name of a key or the contents of a key. And then you can right-click on that key and you can select delete. And that's probably what the person did who was fixing the Chrome problem. And you can use the edit find next or the F3 key to continue looking for a particular given string in there. And then eventually you will get to the string that says finish searching through the registry at the end of it all, and then you're done.
And just on a side note, these instructions actually came from an activity that I undertook yesterday. And I have a proprietary program that accesses some data files and creates a report. And these files are really small. They're between like 5 and 35 kilobytes, so they're really tiny. Usually they load almost instantly. But I found that there was one group of these files that were 15 kilobytes. It was taking 6 to 7 minutes to load one of these files. Now, it turns out that my laptop is exactly the same as the laptop that we purchased for a colleague. So I asked him, how long does it take you to load this file? And the answer was 33 seconds. So his hardware, with the same program and the same data file, is loading something in 30 seconds that takes me 6 minutes. So I tried doing the previous slide. I uninstalled the software. I rebooted the machine. I reinstalled the software. Now it takes 12 minutes to load the file. So I went through this process right here. I went in, I made my backup so I could always restore to where I was. I went through the registry. I deleted all of the keys that I could find to do with this program. And some of them were still protected, even though I was an administrator, and I still had to change the permissions on them. But I blew them all away. I reinstalled the software, and my file now loads in 19 seconds. So it can be a really useful technique, but it's not without its difficulties. So not for the faint of heart, this one, but certainly possible.
Yeah.
Okay, moving along. We have a mini presentation by our very own Bob Walker talking about a utility called BookBub. Are you still there, Bob?
Okay, the first slide here. BookBub, they call themselves a book discovery service. I found out about this site a few years ago. And their mission is to help readers find new books and to help authors find new readers. You can sign up for a daily email that gives you the ebook deals of the day in the categories you've signed up for. Now, we're talking about ebooks here, not real like paper books. Because these are ebooks, they can give you daily deal prices that range from free, which is good, to $2.99. Now, most of these deals are offered for a limited time, and you don't have to sign up for the email service. You can just go directly to their site, and whatever the daily deals are there, along with whatever other books that they're trying to introduce and everything. Now, the advantage with these deals is you can build up a library fairly cheaply. And whereas when you go into a bookstore or you look for real books on Amazon or some other service, you know, sometimes you're like, oh, it's a $20 or $30 or $40 book. And, you know, maybe it's good, maybe not, but I just don't want to pony up for it. But when you're getting them from free to $3, it's pretty easy. Oh, well, this looks interesting. And you can buy the book or download the book. And if it doesn't turn out to be very good, you're not owed anything of any real value. Now, the deals are offered by, in some cases, authors who want word of mouth on their new book. You know, they got a new book out. They're not a super big name author, and they want to get some word of mouth out there. Some of the deals are authors giving you a free or cheaper copy of book one in a series, hoping you'll buy the rest of the series, or they give you a free or cheaper copy of their old series, hoping you'll buy into their new series. Some of the deals are from new authors just looking for any kind of readers. And in the past, for most authors to get a book published, they had to go through a publisher. Now more and more authors, and especially new authors, are self-publishing on the Internet and bypassing the printed books entirely. And some of the deals are offered by authors or publishers looking to get some extra sales out of their older bestsellers.
And Bob, Natalie has a question. Are they for specific platforms for reading? And I think the answer is on the next slide.
Yeah. So BookBub doesn't actually sell the books. You click on the link, and it takes you to the seller's book site. And in the case of BookBub, that's either Amazon, which is their Kindle books, Apple, Google, or Kobo. And then you buy the book from that site. So not all the books and all the deals are available from all the retailers all the time. So a particular deal might only be through Amazon and Apple or just from Kobo or whatever. So all of the retailers offer different free apps so you can read their books on your computer or smartphone. Or in the case of Amazon, Kindle, Apple, and Kobo, you can buy the proprietary e-readers. Now, keep in mind, if you buy an Amazon Kindle, you can't put a Kobo book on it. But on my laptop here, I'm running the Amazon Kindle app and the Kobo app because my wife has a Kobo, and that's what she gets. Okay, next, Alan. Okay, when you click on the retailer's icon in BookBub, like I said, you go to the retailer's website, and when you do that, you get a lot more info on the book, so you're not committed to buying it when you click on the icon. You go to the retailer's site, you can look at what the extra description on the book and all that, see if it makes sense. In some cases, you can actually sort of graze through or flip the pages in the book to see if it's of any interest to you. And at least in the case of Amazon, if let's say you bought a book 2 or 3 years ago, and like I say, you build up your cheap library and you haven't really looked at the book yet and you forgot that you bought that book a couple of years ago, Amazon lets you know that you've already bought this book. So I can't guarantee that the others do the same thing. And BookBub operates an audiobook retailer called Chirp, and I'm not really familiar with this because I'm a visual type of person, and I want to see the book to read it, not listen to it or whatever. So next slide. Now, on the deals email thing, you can set up your preferences to only get deals on the categories of books you choose. And they have over 40 categories. Now, some of these are sort of micro-sliced. There's about 7 or 8 categories of romance, for example, ranging anywhere from new adult romance to dark romance and erotica. So you have to sort of decide if you want to get all the romance categories or whatever. Likewise, how they slice and dice it. Is it a thriller or is it an action and adventure book? So, you know, because it's all free, there's no, you know, you don't sign up for the categories you're definitely not interested in, but you can be fairly liberal in what categories you choose. Okay, next. Okay, this is a screenshot of just a couple of the deals that were available on the day I did up this presentation. And it shows how it is. You get the title of the book, the author, a short description, what the deal price is of the day, and they have crossed out what the regular price of the book is. And you can click on any of the 4 retailers to go further. Now, I have several categories chosen in my preferences. So each day I get offered anywhere between 10 and 30 deals. And you can scan through these really, really quickly. It's not like you're going to be spending half an hour going through them. And in the preferences, you can also select which particular retailers you want to get the deals from. And in my case, I usually get the Amazon books for myself, and my wife has a Kobo reader, so I've only chosen Amazon and Kobo as the retailers to get the deals from. Okay, next. Now, in most of the ebook readers and apps, you're limited to sorting and searching based on the title, the author, and the date that the book was put into your library. Now, what I do is because that doesn't give me enough sorting options, I copy and paste a BookBub description of the title, author, description, and category into a spreadsheet, and that way I can slice and dice it any way I want. And if I don't agree with the category the book is in, or I want to shave it down further, I can do that. I can add other columns for other info that's important to me. And you can also, in your spreadsheet, add ebooks that you might have gotten from somewhere else. Now, in Kindle and Kobo and possibly the other two, you can bring in ebooks from other sources into your library, but I don't particularly want Amazon or Kobo to know exactly what I'm reading. It's enough that they know that I'm reading their stuff. And you can't take a Kindle book and put it into your Kobo library because Amazon, Kobo, and Apple copy protect their books. Now, you may want to remove the copy protection, and this isn't for nefarious purposes of being able to then send an email a book to all your friends and break the copyright rules, but in my case, if I have a good Kindle book I want to share with my wife, I don't want to have to rebuy it for her Kobo or whatever. So if you search on it, there are various apps for removing the copy protection and converting the book into another format. But treat these with care and don't break any copyright laws. And that's about it.
We have a few things in the comments. We have a comment from Tom. A useful open source ebook library is caliber-ebooks.com. Tom also mentioned that Adobe has digital editions, which works with library ebooks, the EPUB format. So that's an option for being able to read books. Bob Gowan comments that Calibre offers conversion between various formats, and you can export to different devices, DDRM them through Calibre. And Bill Van Dyke says there's a similar service for audiobooks at chirpbooks.com. This is all in the chat window if anybody wants to pick up this. Tom had some sample book library from Adobe Digital Editions. There's some free books there. Gutenberg.org is a great source for free books, no longer under copyright. And another place is archive.org, which has millions of books, videos, games, and more. And library ebooks and download audiobooks from ottawa.overdrive.com. And that seems to be all of the chat content there. So that's great.
Yeah, there's all sorts of sources for books on the internet and whatever, including free books. I believe even Wikipedia has a bit of a service as well. So, and for ebooks you haven't got from Kindle or Kobo and DRM'd or DDRM'd, the best application for keeping track of them is that Calibre application.
Okay, thanks very much, Bob. I don't know anybody, I wasn't following all the chat there, but another source for books is the Ottawa, oh, I see somebody's got it, Ottawa Public Library. They have quite a selection of ebooks. So check the chat window, there's all kinds of information there. Okay, so moving on, we've talked about a couple of Google groups, the club's list servers, the announcements list server, and the newsletter list server. Tonight I just want to do the final one, the Ottawa PCU, OPCUG member forum. This is a Google group also, but this is a group that's only available to members. So you have to be a member of OPCUG to be able to join this group, and you have to log in to access the information. Basically, the member, it's a discussion forum. So it's like a 24/7 question and answer forum, if you like. Plus, you'll find that a lot of items of computer news and general interest are posted on the forum also. So if you log on to the web forum, this is from the website, you'll find a list of the current messages. And the point here is that you can change the way that the list server handles your input or your output, I guess, really. If you go down to My Membership Settings down here on the left side, you'll find that I'm subscribed with my opcug.ca email address, and I've subscribed for each email. But this is a drop-down. So if I click on this drop-down menu, you'll see that I can have each mail digest abridged or none. So each email means that anytime anybody posts a message to this list server, you will receive a copy of that message on your regular email account, the one that you subscribed with. If you choose, rather than each email, you choose just a digest, then it sends you the full messages, but it bundles them in amounts of 25, and you only get the message when there's new activity. But there's new activity almost every day, so it's quite likely you'll get at least one message a day. And I've not tried any of these things, so I'm just telling you what Google Groups says they do. If you choose abridged, what you get is a condensed list of the messages. You don't get the full message now. You get the sender, the subject, and just a brief summary of the message. And they're packaged in bundles of 125. And it says they'll send you at least one message a day in this format. If you select no email, it means that people will post messages, but you won't get them in your email address. You'll have to log on to the group and read the messages on the website using your browser. So clearly the easiest one to go with is each email, because we don't get that many messages every day, and that's the more convenient way to receive them and also to reply and even post messages to the group that way. Typically you'll see a message thread. So here's a message that Andrew put on a few days ago. He'd noticed a reference to a Linux-based clone of Windows 10. And he thought it might be a scam or a knockoff of Windows or something like that. And he's saying, is there any truth to it? And does it make old machines run better? And my first thought was that this was the Linux FX, Windows FX clone that we talked about back in September. So I pointed out that we'd done that. But then I got intrigued. I'm interested in Linux. So I looked up this Linux clone of Windows 10. And one of the things that popped out was a program called Windows 12 Lite. And in this particular website anyway, it basically says that it's a Linux version of Windows. It's a Windows clone, I guess. But it's based in Linux. A couple of things. It's a version of Linux Lite with Windows 10 wallpaper, right? So it's really a Linux distro pretending to be or looking a bit like Windows 10. And then the next thing, it isn't available to download from the website. So you can't just download the distro from the website, but you can buy it on a DVD, and it's a UK site, so it's £15 sterling. So that's about $30, I think. Now, that's a red flag to me, because typically Linux distros are free. And you can charge for it if you're providing an extra service like a DVD, but why would you if you can download it for free? So I'm not convinced, and the review of this thing wasn't great, so I don't think that's a particularly good idea.
Pretty expensive anyway, Windows 10 wallpaper.
Yeah, so that's the kind of question and answer thread you might see on the forum. The other thing you might see is a posting just as something interesting, and here's a posting from Micheline about the NUC 11 family of small computer devices from Intel, with links and reviews and that kind of thing. Here's another posting from Chris following up on our discussion at Q&A a few weeks ago about WhatsApp and the changed privacy policy. And he's reporting on Bruce Schneier's take on the privacy policy changes and how Facebook are trying to grab all your information a different way, I guess. And then the final one is just an example. A question came into the suggestion box about games, specifically a cribbage game, and preferably a French version of that game, and could anybody suggest a source? And it also said, you know, what were other good sources of PC games? So I thought that was interesting. I thought it actually came in from Jocelyn, and he said maybe people would be interested in games. So I put this message on the user forum, and tonight you'll see the results. There are a whole bunch of postings, not only just back to suggestion box, but people replied to this message in the forum. So users of the forum have pre-knowledge of some of the suggestions that were made. So for all of our list servers, if you're interested in the announcements group, getting the newsletter by email as soon as it's released, or being able to log on to the members-only forum and accessing the discussion group, and go to the how-to webpage on the website, and it will give you all of the details.
And if you have any problems at all, just email me, and if nothing else, I can sign you up manually.
Okay, so here's the actual question that started things off from Jocelyn. His father was using a cribbage game, but it was based in Flash. And, of course, Flash got cancelled at the end of December. So he's asking, is there any suggestion for an alternative cribbage game, preferably in French? And then the second part was, in general, what would be good sources for games? So the first reply came from Chris.
Yeah, I use Pogo as a game site. So it's www.pogo.com for a lot of different games. I searched, there's no cribbage there, but there are a lot of other interesting games on there. If you like playing games, you can play for free and it's ad supported. So your games will be interrupted periodically with advertisements, or you can sign up for, I think it's about $40 a year and get unlimited ad free gameplay.
And then Jocelyn basically replied to that and said he found one that was interesting. It was free. It was an online game. Didn't require any registration, but it was all in English. But the good side of it was there were other games as well as just cribbage. And then I had found another site, which I sent to Joss, which is specifically about cribbage. So there's a whole raft of cribbage stuff. I think there was an online version of cribbage in French, but I don't think I saw an app per se, but I didn't really spend a lot of time looking. I left it for Jocelyn to take a look in detail. And then Bob Harris came up with a bunch of stuff. These are slightly different games, nothing to do with cribbage now, but this one is it's called Codenames. It's a team game. And it's a team game that you play over the internet. So various people log on to a website using their device. And then you split up into teams and you try and guess various things about the other side, I guess, looking for specific individuals. The second one is a site called Trickster Cards, same kind of thing, play card games over the internet, multiple users again on different devices, and it's often best for these kind of multiplayer games if you also have an open phone line on speaker mode so that you can discuss things and basically communicate verbally about what's going on. And that can be a problem. If you have a phone plan that doesn't have unlimited minutes, you may end up spending 2 hours on the phone playing this game at 35 cents a minute, and that can get pretty expensive. So Bob is suggesting that you can use Fongo, which is a VoIP system, a voice over the internet system, which basically gives you free phone calls across Canada. So you can use Fongo to call your friends on a speaker phone type system and play the game basically as long as you want. Bob, I think his final choice was a chess game. This is an online game where you play against a friend or can be an unknown opponent who's looking for somebody to play with online, or you can actually play against the community, against the computer as a kind of a training exercise too. So Bob has a number of items for thought about this thing. It's free. You can install it on any device. You can play it on the website, and it's free to do that. You just have to sign up for an account. He says it can be tricky to start, but it's not that bad, so don't be discouraged. However, there is a trick. If you're playing with somebody, both players have to make the first three moves in 10 seconds per move, or the game will be aborted. So, I guess it's pawn two squares up and carry on fairly quickly. But then once you've done the first three moves, then you have unlimited time. You can take as much time as you want for future moves. And he says there are many features and lots of custom settings, and it's an enjoyable game. And then Stuart had a suggestion for an online cribbage game. And again, other types of games. This one has other board games at this particular URL. originally it's a Polish system, but it has a whole bunch of games. Chess, I see there, checkers, dominoes, etc., etc. And then I think this is the final game, which is suggested by Chris.
Yeah, I just came across this recently. If you go into Microsoft Edge and in the URL bar type in edge:// surf, it'll actually bring up a surfing game, and you can there's a hamburger menu in the top right that you can go in. You can see some help about how the game is played and so forth. One thing that's not mentioned in there is that you can actually use your mouse as well to move the surfer back and forth. And so it's kind of an interesting little game that you can play in the browser. We do have a couple of comments in the chat. Let's just see. Is an alternative to Fungo. Tom mentions you can use Google Hangouts to make calls as well to communicate. Free for the U.S. and Canada numbers. And Stefan mentioned looking in the Windows Store, there is Cribbage Deluxe that supports French, and he uses the English version. And that's the comments that we have.
One other comment is that although you can't play cribbage on it, there is a very big online system called BridgeBase Online. I sent a link in the notes, but you can play it for free. You can kibitz for free. You can learn stuff for free. And in fact, I'm a director on there, and I run a club on BridgeBase Online called Global Club that runs about 40 to 50 tourneys a week.
Okay, yeah, sorry, I missed that link that you had put in the chat there, Tom. It was above where I had pasted in the links from the tonight's slides. So that's there as well if people want to check it out.
Yeah, I was actually just going to mention that I'd seen it, because I also noticed above that there's another comment. Tom says, why clone Windows 10 in Linux? Linux is better. Which I completely agree with. And Lawrence says, some people just love a challenge.
Keep in mind, people don't run an operating system to run the operating system. They run an operating system to run the programs that run under the operating system.
And Linux runs almost everything. So what's your problem?
Doesn't run my photo editor.
Okay. It probably does on Wine.
It could be.
Anyway, moving along. Stuart has a question. Visual C++ redistributables. Why does he have so many installed? And he points out that Chris was advocating removing unnecessary programs like Java, and he thinks the same thing applies to these Visual C++ things, which are all it's C++, not triple plus, which are cluttering up your PC. One of his PCs has two versions, but others have as many as 8 versions. And the graphic here is actually from my laptop, and if you count, there are 14 versions of Visual C++ installed on my laptop. This is from the control panel. I haven't done that. These are installed by Windows and Windows Update. So Stuart says he understands that some of the programs need Visual C++, and they're tiny programs, so they don't use much space, but he points out some are viruses, so should he be concerned, I guess. And one of the problems is he never sees any updates to versions of C on the PC, although I guess these are really updates, some of them. And then the question is, if I delete all of the C++ programs, will the system find what it needs if a program suddenly decides that it needs C++? I'd seen this thing, and I'd had this same question, but I'd never done anything about it. So thanks, Stuart, for the question, because it made me go look it up. So the answer is, yes, you can, but you shouldn't, essentially, at least according to this How to Geek website, which actually makes a lot of sense when you read what the guy has to say. And he says basically this, that Visual C++ is used to create many Windows applications. And it's part of Microsoft Visual Studio, which developers use to write programs. And the virtual C++ redistributables essentially give libraries of shared codes. These are dynamic link libraries, the DLLs that we all don't know and love. And the good thing about it is that Microsoft provides bug and security fixes for these DLLs. Some of them are installed with Windows, so when you get a brand new version of Windows, you will find Visual C++ redistributables installed on your system. And depending on your processor, you can have both 32-bit and 64-bit versions of the C++. And then individual programs, when you install an individual program, it can install specific versions of C++ that it thinks it needs. So in other words, you end up with multiple versions. There can be service packs amongst them, and there are certainly different version numbers. The real problem is that although they give bug fixes, they don't consolidate the old versions. Now, you could remove all the old versions manually, just delete them from the, or remove them from the control panel window, and just leave the most current version. The article says, we've tested this and found it to be unreliable. So their bottom line is, as Stuart kind of said, they're not causing any harm, they're tiny, they don't take up any space. So my comment is, let sleeping DLLs lie. So I've got 14 versions installed on my laptop, but so be it. I'm gonna go with that. I don't see anything. Tom's got a comment. You can always rename the directories and see if anything breaks. I'm not sure if that belongs to Visual C++, but still. Anyway, that's my take on the Visual C++ redistributables. They're there, and leave them there. So a couple of questions came in from Natalie on defragging. And the first one was, what's your opinion about doing occasional defrags on hard drives? And Chris says...
Yeah, I think defragging on a hard disk drive is fine, and it's not a bad thing to do. And when my main hard drive was a hard disk drive as opposed to a solid state, I would end up doing a defrag at the end of the backup cycle. And one of the reasons why I limited it to when I was going to reinitialize my backups is that one of the disadvantages to defragging is that if you're doing incremental backups, image backups, it sees a lot of changes on the drive, and it will cause incremental backup images to be huge. And so I don't want my image backups to be huge every night just because I'm doing a defrag. And so what I do is I'm in the habit of I reinitialize my backup set every 30 days. I just move all of the files somewhere else. The next time the backup runs, it'll run another full backup. Because it's going to run a full backup anyways, that's actually a good point in time to actually do a defrag on a hard disk drive and then let it do its full backup and then switch back to incrementals. So I would only do, for me, a defrag on the drive when I was going to reinitialize my image backups. If you're not doing image backups, if you're backing up some other method, then that's really not a concern. And so a periodic defrag on your hard drive is probably not a bad idea.
Yeah, Tom wants to know, do the defrag before the backup or after?
Before. So I would do it before the what I do is I move all my backup files to another directory before the next backup runs the next morning at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'll do the defrag so that when it does the full backup, it's doing it on a defrag disk. That's the way I do it.
Okay. Okay. All right, so part two of the question was, what about external, basically USB hard drives? Natalie keeps her data on two drives, a 1 terabyte and a 3 terabyte. So what should you do about defragging multiple external hard drives? And I chose the image here to show that you could have 2, 4, 6, 8 external hard drives in a box. And Chris says,
I would say probably not. It's just another drive. But typically the way most people, I think, use external hard drives is they don't really get an awful lot of activity. They are not used as the primary storage for files. It's a backup of files, or it's occasionally used stuff that, you know, or you're transferring things between multiple computers, that sort of thing. If you're using it for backup for disk imaging, then typically they're going to be these huge files that are anywhere from a couple of gigabytes to a couple of hundred gigabytes in size, and the system might not even be able to defrag the files, and even if it does, the benefit to doing that is probably negligible. And so personally, I wouldn't really worry about defragging. There was a comment that came back on this one that mentioned about the fact that it was being used as primary storage for backup. And I have some thoughts on that. So I guess, I think you have another slide on this, don't you, Alan?
I don't see it right now, but let's see if we get to it. Otherwise, we'll have to come back to that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we'll come back to it if we have to.
Maybe I got these slides out of order or something. Anyway, Tom had sent us a comment about a program that he likes, MyDefrag. It's a free defragging program. It has a lot of disk optimization options. You can configure it to do all kinds of neat things. And one of them in particular is if it has a really big file that it can't defrag completely, it will split it into great big chunks, which it defrags. So to try to speed up access as much as it can. A couple of the downsides, it doesn't defrag exFAT disks, file systems, and apparently it's no longer supported by the developer. But he says it's still available from geeks.com. I think, Tom, you mean majorgeeks.com. That's where I found it, on this website.
Yeah, that's what he
thinks. It's the same version number that you have, so I think that's where it's from.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's put the link in the chat window if anybody's interested. And I had when I was using hard drives, I didn't like the way that Windows ran the defragging system. And I was looking around for an alternative, and I found this Australian product by a company called Auslogix, a dish defrag. And I just thought that gave a better defragging experience than the Windows product. And this is still available. It's still under development, and it's still free. So if you're interested in defragging and you don't like the way Windows does things, there's a couple of different options for you to try something different.
But Auslogix does defrag. Beware, it does things upside down.
Yeah, right. It starts top to bottom or bottom to top. Yeah. So I don't see that file, slide coming up, Chris, about the...
Yeah, okay. My thoughts on primary storage on an external hard drive is, generally speaking, why? Because a lot of computers that have, say, an SSD, first off, you could use your SSD as your primary storage for your files, or a lot of computers that have an SSD also have a built-in hard disk drive. And so if you're not using it, why not? Usually internal storage will actually be a little bit faster, to a lot faster than an external hard drive that you would plug into a USB port. And so my personal feeling is, unless you're really cramped for space internally, then I would use internal storage for primary storage and use external hard drives plugged into the system just for backup, transferring to another system, or for, you know, maybe stuff that you want to have around very occasionally, but you don't want it cluttering up your main hard drive or something like that. But personally, I wouldn't use it for primary storage.
And so the issue there was, although we haven't got the slide right now, Natalie has these two hard drives. One of them, she's basically storing all her documents on that external hard drive. And the other one is a backup drive. But there's a second hard drive in the computer, which has lots of space on it. So you could actually store your documents on that hard drive and just use the external drives for backup storage. And the thought was that you also shouldn't have the external hard drives plugged in all of the time, especially if they're for backup. Because if you had a power surge, it might blow away your backup. And if you got ransomware, it will encrypt all of the drives it can see, including the external drive that's still plugged in. So you really should have the external ones offline. And in fact, Natalie says, I unplug them when they're not in use. So that's the thing to do there.
And Tom pasted in a bunch of information, if anybody's interested, on a lot of the benefits and the way that MyDefrag works. And so if you're interested in some of the capabilities of that program, check out the chat window.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. I keep most of my working files on a 256 gigabyte flash drive. It's a SanDisk one. It just barely sticks out the side of the laptop. And so I can put the laptop in and out of a carrying case and everything. And if I need to do any work on another computer, I can just unplug it, go to the other computer or whatever. And I use Free File Sync, so it automatically syncs up to the computer I'm going to. So it automatically backs up everything as I move it around. But I keep the latest version on and in this one place, and it has all the working files, and it seems to work out fairly well. And I'm well backed up on it, so.
Yeah, those micro USB keys are really good. I mean, it literally sticks out a quarter of an inch. Huge capacities these days.
You can actually have even less of a stick out, because a lot of laptops, at least, have slots for the SD cards, and you can get SD cards that are absolutely huge these days. And you can put that in there and use that for backup or for whatever. And of course, it's also good for, especially for small netbooks where your only storage is on an SD or a micro SD.
Yeah, or a smartphone, same kind of problem. So just a point there that Tom saw that question come up in the announcements list and gave us those suggestions about defraggers. So if anybody has similar comments on things as we go along in future, that's a really useful thing for us to give us extra information over what just Chris and I can think of. Okay, so moving along, a comment I'll share from Stuart. And we've been talking about how to report problems to Microsoft and their bug tracker, which I forget what it's called now. Chris knows that thing.
Windows problem reporter is a...
No, it's not that.
It's not that
thing, anyway. That thing that you use to report bugs to Microsoft.
Yeah.
Anyway, Stuart had found essentially the same thing for Google. So if you go to this issue tracker website, you'll find that there'll be all kinds of problems being reported on Google, and that's where you can actually add your problem also. Okay, now I see the problem. Here's the other question about for the hard drives. Clearly, I got it slightly out of sequence. All right, so it was basically about the two hard drives and the unused hard drive on the PC. We talked about the question, and then Chris had said there's probably no good reason to use it, especially if you've got room on the internal hard drive, and it will be faster, and, you know, don't have external drives plugged in when you don't need to. There you go. All right, so Chris has a share here on troubleshooting Windows Update.
Yeah, it was just an interesting thing I happened across on my main computer. And I went in and I noticed that there was an error on the Windows Update. And interestingly, I never got a pop-up telling me this. So I only saw it when I went into Settings, Update, and Security. And I checked and there was an error message displayed there saying that there were problems downloading some updates and they'll try again later. So I clicked on, you know, they said, you know, you can try again. So I clicked on check for updates and it still came up with that same thing after about 2 seconds. So it was really quite quick that it decided it couldn't do it. So first thing in my methodical approach to fixing problems is let's see if the problem goes away. And so I tried for several days going in and clicking on the check for updates to see if the issue just maybe it was magically something at Microsoft's end that was causing it, something like that, that maybe got fixed. It didn't fix it. So the next thing I did was I ran the Windows Update Troubleshooter, which is under Settings, Update and Security Troubleshoot, and it came back after a couple of minutes saying that it didn't find anything that it could fix. So the next thing I did was I tried running Disk Cleanup, figuring that one of the options in Disk Cleanup, if you go to Start and you type in Disk Cleanup, when it loads, you click on the button that says clean up system files, and then one of the options that you will have available is Windows Update Cleanup. And I thought maybe there was something in there that if I just cleaned up the Windows Update Cleanup, that maybe that would fix the problem. So I let it run. I retried Windows Update, and it failed again. So then I went to the nuclear option. One other thing. I thought that maybe there was some other program that was actually causing this to fail. I run a program called Glasswire, which can block outbound connections from my computer so that malicious software and so forth won't run. And I thought maybe I had accidentally at some point blocked an outbound connection that was to do with Windows Update, and it was causing this particular update to fail. So what I did was that I stopped the Glasswire service, I reran the Windows Update, and it failed yet again. So I finally came down to the nuclear option, and I'm going to paste into the chat window about this as well. So what this is going to do is reset the entire Windows Update configuration. And to do it, you run an elevated command prompt. So you run as administrator on the command prompt. And then, next slide, type in the following commands. And so there's a bunch of net stops, which is basically just stopping some services. There's a rename on two directories. And that is the only the critical aspect of it to reset the Windows Update system. You have to get rid of the original directories, C:\Windows\Software Distribution, and C:\Windows\System32\Catroot. And so in this sequence of events I have here, I just renamed them to another directory so if I needed to, I could actually bring back that configuration by renaming them. And then I start the services again. So the important thing is that those services have to actually be stopped before you can actually rename those directories or delete those directories. So watch for any errors that you see in there. In particular, when the two folders get renamed or if you choose to just delete the folders, watch for any error that says that the folder could not be renamed or could not be deleted. The renaming or deletion of those folders is really all that needs to be done, but it has to be done for both the folders to reset things properly. And I found that if I deleted the or I stopped the services and then I waited more than a couple of seconds to rename those folders, the services were actually restarting and locking the folders again. So you can go in and you can actually set the services so they are not set to start, but I just did it really quickly and then I managed to get the folders deleted or renamed before the service tried to start again. And then eventually the two folders were renamed. So when the services started running again, it rebuilt those two folders automatically. And my final outcome on it was I ran the Windows update. It went off. It updated that. It downloaded them, installed them. And after the reboot, I ran Windows update again, and it said I was up to date. So just an interesting sort of troubleshooting that I had to do on my system. If you ever run into a problem with Windows Update, that nuclear option seems to be one that will pretty much always work to get Windows Update working again.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So we're at the point where we just went out of prepared questions, so if there are any other questions, shout out. However, there is one question in the queue. Michelin says, I'm looking for a modern 10th or 11th generation CPU with four USBs on the front and the back. Does anybody have any suggestions? And you have to unmute yourself to answer or put something in the chat window.
Now, Bob Walker here. If you don't have enough USB ports on the particular card or computer that you're looking to use, you can always get a USB hub. And, for example, Amazon has one which gives you six USB ports, and it's a powered hub, so it can do USB charging and everything as well, and it's like under $30. And so regardless of how few USB ports the computer actually has on it, you can always add on to it very easily. And if you use the USB ports to plug in stuff like printers and scanners and all that, you can literally unplug the hub from your main computer and plug it into your laptop, and boom, all your stuff is now usable from your laptop as well.
Okay, thanks, Bob. So if anybody has any thoughts about new computers, send it along to Suggestion Box or put it in the members forum.
And Natalie has a question. Any recommendations for a program to convert old digital camera .mod files, MOD, video files to MP4? So if anybody has an idea on that.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I think you'd have to look up, maybe. I don't know.
Elizabeth has a question. Is there any camera that you can plug into a Windows 10 desktop that does not need a driver? Every hardware device needs a driver. A lot of them will be supplied automatically by Windows, but that's what a driver does, is it allows the operating system to talk to a piece of hardware, whether it's a keyboard, a hard drive, your screen, a video, whatever. So every device, hardware device, actually needs a driver.
But almost any USB camera that you plug into your computer will have a driver in Windows, so it's usually not much of a problem.
Yeah. And Natalie Jocelyn just posted in a URL into the chat on a convert MOV to MP4. So you could check that out. Stefan has to change format of video files and many other parameters, use software called Handbrake. Stefan, is that a freebie, do you know? Or?
It's a freebie.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Jocelyn mentions that VLC is a great video player, so it may actually be able to play your MOV files if all you're interested in doing is playing them.
And I think it also does conversion.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
I think it does.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
I believe it does.
Good to know.
One question I have is that I have some Sony headphones. Whoops. apparently they sound okay, but when I'm receiving stuff from Zoom, it breaks up. It's stuttery. On the other hand, when I'm playing something from a website, then I cannot. I don't have any problems with it. It plays music just fine. Any suggestions?
I presume you've checked with the Sony website to see if there's an updated driver for it?
I think I'm updated as of a couple of weeks ago anyway.
Yeah, that should be. Yeah, it's pretty current.
You sure that the Zoom feed is contiguous? It's not a question of somebody having a poor internet connection and...
Well, if I look at the statistics, I'm using about 8% of my CPU and only 13 gigabytes of my memory of my 64 gigabytes. So it's not limited by that.
No, but it may be the signal coming in. I was on a conference today with a colleague, and the Zoom was telling me my internet connection was unstable, and he was seeing the screen freezing and not hearing anything and things like that. So if you had a minor glitch like that and the signal was getting interrupted periodically, you would hear a stuttering type situation.
Yes, but that's not a problem when I listen to, for example, I'll send this link in the description. I don't have any problems with it listening to media files on my computer or listening to websites such as this Radio Garden. By the way, this Radio Garden, for people who are interested, you really don't need Spotify, because with Radio Garden you can go around the globe and listen to thousands of different radio stations using Radio Garden. Radio.garden.
Cool.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. I was on a Zoom conference last week with about 100 users, and I was simultaneously doing a news feed download in high definition and checking my emails and a couple other things online, and everything else worked fine, including the high definition news video feed, but the Zoom kept on freezing on me. And so there are definite issues with Zoom, whether you're using it all by itself or whether you're using it in combination with other things. So I think the problem with your headphones might have a lot more to do with Zoom than it has to do with the headphones
Sony
themselves.
That's what I thought, but I was hoping for some solution, because I'm only using like 13% of my CPU for everything right now, so.
Yeah. Well, are you using the Sony headset now, Tom?
I am.
And is it breaking up at all?
Yes, it's continually breaking up. It's not like it stops and starts and so on. It's just it's going to be the words. There's all kinds of excess chaff in the audio. I can still understand it, which is why I'm still using them.
Okay.
But I would be. I'd love a solution.
It's interesting because I haven't noticed anything on the audio tonight. It's all sounded really good.
Yeah, it's been good for me as well. So it sounds like it is something to do with your headset or something like that. I don't know.
Oh, I agree. When I put it on the speakers or whatever, then I don't have a problem. I'll try another headset next time and see if that works.
So okay. Justin is asking, says last time he checked, the bank didn't allow Windows 10 to deposit checks online, and he doesn't have an Android device, I guess. I wonder if the Android simulator mentioned would work. Good question.
Well, let us know, Joss.
Yeah, try it out. That's right. Okay.
Maybe time to change your bank.
We're almost about 10 minutes over time. So if anybody has any other questions, then send them along for next week. Last two slides. Our next regular meeting, the February meeting for the club, will be on the 10th, 7:30 p.m., and it will be on microcontrollers and IoT, the Internet of Things. Now, Dee Grimer is back with us from Victoria. He's the guy that gave a presentation last year on the Raspberry Pi. So if you're interested in that, join us on the 10th. And next week will be our next question and answer session, the 3rd. If you have any questions, things that you want to share, send them to our suggestion box email, and we will be pleased to highlight your issues and or suggestions. Other than that, thanks everyone for attending. Hope you enjoyed it. I thought we had a really good session tonight, all kinds of good stuff. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for coming, folks. We'll see you next week.
Good night.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. See you next week.